Hello, Reliability Gang. Welcome back to another episode of the Reliability Gang podcast. I'm here with my man, Will. How are you keeping, buddy?
Doing very well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for everyone that tuned into the AI podcast, man. We got so many downloads on that. That was, again, I knew it would because
it's an up and coming topic,
AI, isn't it? Man. Come on, who's not going to want to listen to these things? But the feedback was great because I got a lot of messages on LinkedIn Messenger, basically just saying thank you for just explaining it in a way that looks at both sides of the coin. Because at the minute, I do feel like, the, you know, the thing is, when you see only one side of things, things can seem, you know, to be pushed in one direction a little bit. And I think having a bit of a viewpoint on both sides of positives and negatives is so important. So thank you for everyone that tuned into that. I think we've nearly got, you know, in total, including the YouTube viewage and the downloads, around about 150 interactions, including both on both platforms. So that's a massive result for that, guys. So thank you so much for tuning in and everything like that. Today is going to be a little bit different. We've got some exciting news at Mainsane as well. So we have been on the hunt for quite a while for a base, okay? And we have finally now found the perfect place to call home for Mainsane Reliability. As you all know, I started in electromechanical world. Will started, you know, in the engineering world on site as well. So engineering was our thing, wasn't it, back in the day?
That's where we both started.
That's what I love, and passion for this game kind of evolved into condition monitoring and everything, you know, before it. So we have finally found the base, and this base is perfect for us because it allows us now to be able to really do what we need to do. So training was something that I've always wanted to do and do it well, you know, and I think our vision of what we wanted to be as a training academy from an early time in Mainsane was so important, but it takes time.
Yep.
All these things take time. So we had the knowledge, but you need to have the base. You need to have the resource.
The processes.
Processes in place as well. And thank you so much for Mobius for keeping patient with us because, you know, I think they see the potential of what we can bring for the future as well. But as well, they understand that we're a growing business and we're doing work and we're growing different models and all the rest of it. So thank you so much for Mobius for keeping patient with us as well, because we've delivered a lot of training the last 2 years, but we're now about to be able to really...
In a more structured way, isn't it, for the new year? At the minute, it's been like, oh, we've got some customers here that want some training and we're going to do this. Whereas in the new year, I think we can start being like, right, we are going to be running and Mainsane training on this day in partnership with Mobius.
100%. We can be structured with it rather than, you know, we've been quite sporadic this year, but we've had to be just to make things work. You know, it's not been easy. It's never an easy task. So, you know, the training side of things is amazing. We've got a base for that. We've got a base as well for the analysis hub. So now, obviously, when the guys are in there doing reports on the Friday, and we did have a base before, and thank you for Lamberts for, you know, letting us use their space as well, which is so grateful for the beginning of our business. But now we need to grow. We need to be able to have our own space and not be intrusive. So we always had that space where we can do reports in the office on Fridays and give the lads support, give them training. But now we've got our own space to do that, and we can really make it into like an analysis hub. Do you know what I mean? I want to be able to have setups where the guys can go in there, we can get a bit of training, do the reports, get some feedback, we can be in there with them, and they can have that nice kind of environment where we're all together. I think that's really important, togetherness and everything. And the other side to it is a workshop. So this has been a bit of a dream of mine for a while, if I'm honest. We talked about this 2 years ago when we were kind of manifesting our future in terms of what would be cool to be able to do. And one thing about the detect, solve, improve model that I've always really got in deep thought about is closing the loop on how do we actually achieve reliability. So when it comes down to repair, essentially, when I first started out in Eric's workshop, we see just the catastrophic end result of failure. That's what the repair shop's for. You know, so bearing defects, core drag, motor blown up, you know, like it was, and it was always, you know, generally a lot of the time, some of the stuff was there to be repaired over a period of time, which was, you know, could be waited for. But a high percentage of that work was generally, oh my God, we need it repaired, repair it now, the line is down. And it was such a pressurized environment to be in. I quite liked it, you know, and I quite liked that environment. But at the same time, it doesn't kind of foster a good environment to get things done reliably, I believe.
Precision.
Precision.
Maintenance.
Yeah. Exactly. Because if you think about it, if you've got a manager in your ear every single half an hour, have you any further on that? When's that going to be done, Will? Like when you're winding a motor, for example. I started as an amateur winder. And it's such a niche skill to learn as well. I loved it, though. It was such an art form of like placing the coils and making it look nice. And I'm quite an artistic person. So I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it. But when you're getting rushed, you know, because essentially, as much as art form it is, the customer's line's down. They're losing thousands of pounds per hour. And it's a bit like, I think the reason why I love getting involved in the condition monitoring game was because I knew what the pressure was on that workshop floor. It was such a pressurized environment. Yep. And it was always now, get it done, get it in so the line gets going again. So the ability to be able to predict these things before they got to that stage for me was really, really enlightening, because now we had the power to prevent these hostile environments where
it was rushing.
And if you look at reliability, right, in terms of precision maintenance and doing things in a way that preserves the life of this machinery, if you're in them environments, are you achieving 100% reliability for that asset to go back in again, especially when you're in that rushed environment?
Are you doing everything properly? Are we looking?
Yeah.
And precision maintenance is such a big part of reliability. We know that infant mortality is a big part of a lot of issues. And so if we're not doing our repairs in a precision manner, in the right environment, with the right tools and equipment.
Yeah, and so true, Will.
You're never going to achieve good reliability on the assets going back. We've all experienced assets that have just been recently repaired and then a year later they've got an issue with them.
Yeah, even stuff that we've potentially called.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not naming any names, but when they get back in, we test them, then we find out that... Yeah. You know, they haven't bored and bushed the housing, for example, and the housing defect's still there. And it's a bit like, oh, I could probably change the bearings. But did they really look at the house? Did they look at all the elements
of...
Have they
measured the tolerances to make sure that it's within the acceptable criteria?
All these different things as well, that kind of, you know, precision maintenance always ties into making sure your assets are most reliable as possible. So for us to be able to have this element now, that we can now be even more in control, because obviously we do a lot of on-site services, bearing changes. I'm sure you guys see the post on the Maintain Reliability page of all the pictures of all the bearing changes we've done, and you know all of that. And we take a lot of pride in doing that in precision maintenance practices of laser alignment, belt alignment tools, measuring the tolerances of the belt tension. We love it because
we have a very strong ethos of, we're going to do it right and right the first time. And if we can't do it right, then we need to look at other options, because there's no other option than doing it right.
Yeah. And I think that's the moral belief system that we've got to maintain. Like even now when we changed the name to Maintain Reliability, it reminds you of, okay, are we doing it reliably? Are we doing everything we can in this process to make sure the output is reliability? So I think now, in terms of opening this new place where we can do repairs, we're not really looking at like volume-based, get it in, get it out the door type of approach. What we're looking for is reliable repairs where we can serve our current customers first. I think that's the idea of closing that loop of reliability. So if they do have an issue with a motor, or we do detect anything, or, you know, we do detect anything with our vibration or our PM checks or whatever, there's an environment where we can incorporate that reliability back into that circle
of
life.
And it's traceability and accountability. They're the two words I quite like with this, what we're doing with Detect, Solve and Improve, in that, you know, we can detect the problem and we have the trend history and we have the vibration data to back up that we've seen an out of race defect. Then that asset is going to be able to come into the maintenance workshop. We're going to be able to track and locate and identify the defect visually that we've actually seen in the vibration data. We can report against that with our findings. We can look at the root cause of the failure, so that once we repair that asset to get it into a as good new state, we can then produce the report. The asset can go back into service. We can retest it And then we can make recommendations as part of the improve part to maybe prevent why that failure happened in the first place. And what we've got there is we've got full traceability of what's going to happen and what has happened and how to prevent it. And then once that asset is in service, we've got accountability then that to make sure that our repair was done in a precise manner to prevent it from happening.
And the onus is on us then.
And then it's our responsibility.
It's our responsibility, because once we've done that repair, and this is why it's important to have these, you know, these real key quality ingredients for reliability in the process of that start to finish of getting the motor in to end result, even to the testing element. And, you know, what you've mentioned there, Will, is very important, is the root cause. Like, these are the things that we have to look at of like, well, why is it even in this repair shop in the first place?
How many times do you guys probably listening, you've probably experienced this, do you send a motor away because it's failed? Maybe it was picked up on a condition monitoring program. Maybe you don't have CM and it was just a failure and you've sent it away from repair. The priority there on for you at site is, I've got to get this going again. Engineering manager is going to be, I've got to get production working again. In that high hostile environment, it's not that the priority for them isn't at that moment in time is necessarily about reliability. It probably should be, but
it's just not that reality.
And so
I agree,
as soon as that asset is back running again, is there that follow-up back with the repair shop? How did that fail, and are they actually going to be able to deliver, this is how you can prevent it from happening again? Is that in their necessarily best interest?
Probably not, no, because if you're looking at a repair shop that looks at volume, then the idea of their KPI in terms of metrics is the fact they probably want it to fail again. If you're looking at a pure business model, that is.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? In terms of just
not
monetary
take
value.
Take moral out
take
of
morals
it.
Out of it and everything. We've got to look at it as a business model. You know, essentially, how do repair shops that are not, you know, being measured on reliability and what they're doing, how do they essentially make their money? Yeah. They want things to fail. It has to fail for it to come in to be a repair in the first place. So what we're proposing in terms of our business model is not,
it's not high volume.
This is not a high volume venture for us. This is not something that is like its own kind of business model that needs to survive on the fact that we need all these repairs to come in. It's an extension to the detect, solve, improve model.
Yeah.
And this is not easy, guys, right? As a business model, this is so challenging in what we're doing. And we face these challenges every day and these difficulties because when you're looking at a business and you're looking at the key metrics that make that successful, when you do open a repair shop, you've got to look at the fact that you want the volume of work for it to be successful, if that's all you're doing.
Yep.
What we're doing is saying, right, detect, solve, improve is the journey to reliability. How do we create a business model that incorporates all of it in one? And that's so difficult because you need lots of different skills. You need lots of different training. You need lots of understanding. You need to have some really good customers that understand what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? Because essentially, if they're not on this reliability journey, then detect, solve, improve doesn't really mean a lot, does it? You know, if you've got a company that just only wants an asset to be repaired and get it back in as soon as possible without real the thought of how long that asset lasts, then our business model doesn't really support their vision, does it?
No.
So this is, again, you know, why we work with selective companies that have the idea of reliability and want to get that output. And eventually, everybody probably will have the viewpoint of trying to get there because we know it's so important for any business to be successful in the long run. You know, about getting out of that maintenance reactive cycle, you've got to be able to look at reliability and bring everyone together to see, well, how do we get out of this, first of all? But then how do we make sure and maintain what we're doing in the future is reliable and we stay out of it?
And it's about like looking at reliability as a whole. And when we look at the reliability journey that is outlaid out in ARP and CMRP and all these topics that come under it, you've got very key elements that are required as part of that journey within reliability. And what we're now finding is we're doing a lot more work with customers on this is there's a very large proportion of this that you can't outsource. You can't go and go get a contractor to just go and do. You've got to build a reliability team within the business and get a steering group together and get everyone within that business on the same path of understanding of reliability. But there are some key parts of it, though, that can be supported with, that can be condition monitoring. You might have a reliability team on site, but do you really want to be pulling your engineers out of their proactive maintenance and out of their breakdowns if you are having them, do you want to pull them out and having them going around with the condition monitoring kit that's, you know, you're going to have to invest in, and it's going to be, you know, it can be done, but it's certainly not easy? Or would you rather have an expert team come involved that looks at vibration data day in, day out, and can advise? So CM could be something that can be easily outsourced, as can your repairs. You don't necessarily have
in-house
to have
repair shops. Like back in the day, that was very
it
common.
It was the thing, but you know, we're in a skills shortage in the UK, as is everywhere else.
It's very difficult, isn't it? Even to get the right engineers, you know, within your plant to
the amount of times where we see tapered sleeve bearings and we get in the vibration data is loose.
Oh, mate. Very high
because they haven't been tightened up sufficiently. And there's an education piece there that needs to be done. But what all comes under that reliability piece is there's certain stuff that needs to be done in-house. There's certain bits that can be outsourced and detect and maybe solve.
But you are right.
This.
Even your example there was very, very valid, because we've got a current customer now where, you know, we've been detecting almost the same issue every time. And we've been saying, guys, that this is such an important thing that you need to do when you replace these bearings in terms of making sure they're tightened up to the right tolerances. And, you know, again, it's education, because essentially they're capable of doing what needs to be done, but it just needs to be done in a slightly precision way. That little bit extra care when that process is being done doesn't actually add a massive amount of time onto the job, does it?
No, but that's
the implication.
Are huge.
Like, now we don't have to plan that job in again after 2 years just because we've got a bit of looseness. But they're not even that. What's the implication of having that looseness on the shaft? Well, now the shaft is potentially damaged.
And that's, again, where this falls into the rest of the business, of the training side of things. So eventually what we want to be able to do is offer these. How do we install tapered sleeve bearings in a precise manner? Because we're not going to be able to do everything. But we're able to offer this circle of reliability as such of, you know, we can detect the problem, we can improve and add precise maintenance, we can go and do consultancy with reliability and do that work, and we can do the training so that you can deliver it on site and at that level. But a big part of reliability, which kind of factors into us trying to create this like repair workshop, is that there's a big part of who do you use as your vendors, who do you use as your suppliers, and what is the vetting process to make sure? How 100%. Many people have gone to their repair workshop, especially, I'm not too sure about other parts of the UK, but here in East Anglia, we've got a lot of very small repair workshops, 2, 3, 4 people. They're not, you've got your big normal names that everyone is familiar with, but we've got quite a lot of small ones. How many times have you been there and said, how can you demonstrate to me, the customer, that you're how you're doing this reliably? What are your procedures? What are your techniques?
What is the quality assurance measures that allow...
Quality.
Yeah, allow for you. And it's all about putting the measures in place and demonstrating that the fact that these are the actions that we do from start to finish from the repair that prevent this asset going back into service without having the defects as well. Because essentially, we are in this argument as well, and we're looking at sustainability as well now, of repair or replace. As parts have got cheaper, as a lot of manufacturing has now been outsourced to different parts of the world, parts are cheaper. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, but then what is the impact of buying something new to the reliability of that new asset being manufactured? And what is the quality of that and opposed to repairing something as well?
And effectively with reliability, whether you're doing a repair or you're buying as new, in the reliability world, we would consider those to be a repair, would be putting that asset to an as new state.
Or if not, even better.
If not, and often, you know, there are workshops that we work with already, and they will balance a rotor of a motor better than what the manufacturer will.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's how it could potentially be better
than what we're doing.
And I know people are like, what? How could that be a thing? Because the problem is we have to be careful not to get into the assumption, because it's new is okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Or it's good. Is it a reputable manufacturer?
Oh, it's new. But that's the thing. And that's where acceptance testing comes in with our industry. Just because it is manufactured new, how have they demonstrated that when that is leaving the factory, that it's going to be sufficient and reliable for your process and your plant? Yeah. And we've got to get out of assumption. We've got to make sure that we're backing up our actual data with proper data.
Acceptance testing is such a great example.
How many times have we been in this scenario where
brand new fans or whatever
it is are completely not fit for purpose when we're going out to test them? And it's shocking. Yeah. And we're like, how has this even happened? And it opened our eyes up to this whole world. And this is why we're telling our customers as well now, if you're ever buying any brand new equipment, make sure that within your agreements of your acceptance of these things, because you can do that in negotiation. Standard. Of course you can. If someone's buying something brand new from, say, for example, I'm selling fans, for example, right? They're more than within their rights to ask me, is that fan going to be fit for purpose? But how are you going to prove it, Will? I don't want to take your word for it. I want to see data, and I want to understand that data is reliable. And when it comes to me, I've got peace of mind that it is going to be able to work, and the warranty is going to be able to hold up in itself in the fact that it's going to be good for me, you know. And this is the thing as well when it comes down to, you know, assets that come back from repair. What testing measurements have been put in place to ensure when it does go back, it is okay.
Yep.
And what we can do is actually do two parts of that. Test it within the workshop environment. And remember, that's not under load. This is where people have to recognize that as well. Can it be tested in a proper environment where it's going to be to prove? Yep. And how was that also, and this is another real big problem I think a lot of repair shops have got, it might have been fine leaving the factory, but who's installed it? Have they aligned it?
Yeah.
Is it tight? There's a lot of factors that can cause that perfectly well-repaired mower to fail prematurely just from the maintenance cycle of when it goes back in as well. So if we can have a little bit of control over that or advise what is acceptable and then test afterwards to confirm it, then I believe that is the way forward, because then we have complete accountability is moving forward that asset, that important
asset. And it's traceability as well.
It's traceable in terms of where it begun, where it started, and really hoping it doesn't come back.
And that's where, like, what it would be great, like we were talking about this the other day on our many car journeys where we have to call each other. And we were talking about how nowadays, you know, you take your BMW car, whatever, to the service centre, and they now send you a little video.
Hello, I love that. I've been there as well. Yeah,
taking a video. Yeah. This is your car, and we've done the service and the tyres. There's an advisory and all this. How great would it be? You know, you send your motor in for repair. Hello, customer. You know, this is the motor. This is what we've identified. These are the things we've put in place because we found that the housing has become a bit loose. So we've made a bore and bush, and we've done this, and we've put new bearings in. We've identified that the lubrication was slightly burnt, and so we've put a report together to make you aware about the lubrication practices. This is something we can support with. This is what we've done. Then that motor has the vibration checks, the mega checks, the electrical winding checks. All of that documentation is kept with that machine, as is all of the documentation of the fault we identified as part of detect. That then gets installed, whether it's by us or with the maintenance team, in a precision manner. Then it's acceptance tested to make sure that all of that work, nothing has given any effect to it, and all of that is fully traceable to then say, right, this is the history on that machine.
Oh, beautiful. I mean, that is beautiful. I mean, that is music to my ears. And this is the thing as well, where we're thinking. Do you know what I mean? And we're not even saying that we want to take over your maintenance. Not at all. We want to work with you to the point where that reliability metric is ticked. Does that make sense? So whether that is us coming and doing it in a precision way, or potentially us trying to give some advice, a bit of training. Like, one thing I want to do within our workshop is get some rigs where we've got these bearings in different places, and we understand how to fit a bearing correctly. And what is the implication if you slightly cock a bearing or you whack a bearing on? You know, why do we use bearing heaters and have that precision element of putting it on carefully? What is the actual impact of a slight bit of contamination in something that could potentially cause a snowball effect for something to fail? What is the implication of not tightening a taper sleeve bearing up correctly, or it being too loose or over tightened as well? Yeah. Why is there tolerance sets for these things, and how do we measure them, and why is it important? And that's the thing, we got to know why. Because no one's going to care otherwise.
Yeah.
They got to know what the implication of not doing it is. Because if not, well, no one's going to change the way they do things. No. All habits are based on the form of what the outcome is, right? So if you're reinforced habits of you doing everything, and then the outcome is potential failure 3 years down the line. But if that's normal to you and you think that's okay, then you're not going to change your behavior.
No.
But the reality of knowing that 3 years could be 10 or 15 or 20, then now you've got a metric to understand, okay, my actions do mean something. And I think all engineers do care deep down. But after a period of time, you can see that some are kind of demoralized by the fact that they know if they try to implement something a bit better, what is actually going to have the impact on the business or whatever, are they going to get the buy-in? Do you know what I mean? And I think that's where we see a lot of frustrated engineers, don't we, in that sense of feeling like, it doesn't matter what I do.
I think that comes from the improved side of maintain, though, at the moment, that we're still trying to, like, we've got the condition monitoring side, and I think we do that really well, and we keep doing our continuous improvement cycle to get it better, as we've just redone our reports for this year. We've got Solve that's kind of going to really kick off in the new year now we've got this new unit, and reliability now is, you know, I was talking with one of our customers this week, and we were talking about how few people fully understand reliability, and we're still on our own journey of understanding that. And I've done my ARPE. Will's now going to hopefully do that in the new year, but even then there's still more understanding of how to implement it, that just that knowledge is just not taught or available in the UK. So I think for a lot of our customers is they know they want to improve reliability.
What's the expected roadmap to do it? Like, I spoke to a really good engineer manager the other day, and his journey and kind of where he gets, and it was just like music to my ears, this discussion that we had.
Yeah, because there's not many that you can say, you just get it.
He was telling me everything I wanted to hear about where I thought they should be moving forward. And there's a bit like, I've had this customer since I started my business. And don't get me wrong, we've been doing incredible condition monitoring for these guys, and we've detected a lot of issues, but we've never really advanced it on the stage of like understanding, well, how do we get a bit better with the reliability element? How do we get the criticality studies better?
Yeah.
How do we actually implement and enforce that? And you're right, Will. It can't just be done on our side of the table. It's got to be a complete buy-in and from the company as well.
I think we've done condition monitoring for so long now within the UK really well. There's places obviously always are open for improvement. But when you start really expanding the reliability piece of work and we're seeing more reliability engineers is becoming a common role within the factories.
Yeah.
But you realise, not saying condition monitoring is insignificant, but it's such a blip in the part of reliability.
It's such a small part.
It's
like sometimes I believe that condition monitoring is used as more of a blanket to say, oh, we are doing something, a lot of these things. But it's like, well, you're putting a blanket over something. That's just it's not an excuse not to do the other things.
It's like, we know we're unreliable, so we're just going to do condition monitoring.
Yeah, exactly. But that doesn't really get you reliable, all you're doing is just identification. And the other part of the root cause analysis and implementation, even if we do the root cause and we do that study of, like, oh, it's failed because of this, the action is, if we're not doing that repair or re-putting that bearing in or installing that device, whatever it is that needs to be done in a precision way that prevents the first original failure from happening again, you're back in the loop.
And there's a whole piece as well that not many people talk about, which is the default is, oh, something's failed, we need to do root cause analysis. Well, really, root cause analysis or root cause failure analysis is to be done on the random failures that just catch you out. The other stuff, like poor lubrication, oh, you know, we found a bearing, it's poorly lubricated, let's do a root cause analysis. What root cause analysis is there. Defect elimination is meant to look at, we need to eliminate the defects before they happen. So we need to make sure we've got a lubrication place in place. So we should really be looking at as a whole, which we're not quite doing yet, which again, the defect elimination part, it falls into, are we sending our equipment to a reliable repair workshop?
Of course, because if for example, you're identifying that, you know, potentially poor lubrication is an issue through that defect elimination process, and you know that where you're sending your stuff is not getting lubricated adequately.
We need to eliminate
You've got to vet that, though. The whole idea is
looking at, can we eliminate the potential of a defect occurring before it even happens?
That's
lubrication
proactive.
Is easy. We can eliminate that by having color-coded,
yeah, but
good
how many times do you see on site that something has been over-lubricated, poorly lubricated, schedule? It's crazy.
But it all falls again under, you know, proactive maintenance. Are we doing the right maintenance practices?
A lot of the time,
in all the failures we see, we never see a failure and go, do you know what, that bearing just lasted its lifetime.
God,
that was a
good one, that, and it just, you know,
it went on for ages and it just felt, no, it's, oh, motor was designed in wrong spec or wasn't aligned. wasn't installed correctly, has been over lubricated. It's very rare that we find a bearing that has failed and gone, do you know what, it just happened to last its life.
And it randomly failed. Purring beautifully. And that's the thing though, isn't it? Like, the need for condition monitoring is always going to be there. But if you do that defect elimination right, properly from the get-go, incorporate precision maintenance in the ethos of what you're doing as a natural progression into your plant, then you're going to find less problems.
If you look at the reliability piece and you look at it all, you know, when you look at the Nolan and Heat research, if you're not familiar, have a look into it. It all talks about the rate of failure, right? Often the time, the most common one is where we have this infant mortality slope where right at the point of a new installation or a new repair, the rate of failures are generally higher. And then it gets to a point where the rate of failures, the chance the machine's going to fail, becomes constant. It has an equal chance of failing because it's random. That piece there is why we do condition monitoring.
Because we don't know when it's going to fail.
We don't know when it's going to fail.
We have no clue.
It's random. So we do condition monitoring to detect the random failures. The infant mortality piece, that piece has to be prevented by making sure we design the equipment right, making sure we laser align it. If we are getting equipment repaired, have we sent it to a reliable repair workshop, or have we done that repair in-house reliably? If we can cross off all those bits, then we reduce the chance of failure in that first few months, in that first few years. And once we hit that point, that machine should run well. And then at that point, the failure is random.
Yeah.
As long as we lubricate it, as long as we do our proactive maintenance and we keep it clean and we keep it inspected, the risk or the likelihood of that failure happening is the same throughout its life. It could go in 6 months. It could have a random failure. But that's why we do condition monitoring, because we know that bearings
don't
have a constant failure rate. Bearings don't fail every 12 months on the dot.
Now, if we knew that, we would just change.
We would just do interval based.
And you save a hell of shit ton of, you know, money.
And that's where the detect side, you know, works really well, and the Sol side and us being able to provide these repairs work really well. But this is how now the improve and the reliability stuff all factors into these why we're creating the repair workshop.
Because they're the metrics at the minute, I do believe, when people are sending their things away. And this is maybe something that the repair workshop organisation that does need to step up their game with. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm not saying they're doing the job incorrectly. They might have all of these quality measures in place, but how are they demonstrating that?
But are we shouting about it as well? How many of the repair workshops are saying we're doing reliable repairs?
Mate, Fletcher Morland, definitely.
Definitely.
You know, great video as well by him as well. And this other myth, that the fact that when you rewind the mower that you lose 15% efficiency every time.
Is that a myth?
Well, what Matt was describing within the video, if you do the right things within that repair, then it doesn't have an effect on it. But again, this is a problem as well with this information, where what is pushing people to do is buy brand new assets, which is not the best for sustainability, if that makes sense, because they have to be manufactured. And again, what we did find is, you know, one of our customers, procurement, liked to buy a cheaper model of mower. And every time we did detect an issue or problem, it was so evident that it was not being based upon reliability. That was just being based upon price or cost. But every 6 months that we go back to that particular asset, we were identifying there was a housing defect because they weren't manufactured in the highest quality. You know, essentially, that motor wasn't designed to be reliable because it's cheaper. But the fact is, really, who wants to be playing that risk with their plant? It's a bit like you having a really expensive BMW or your car you love, and then the parts that you're buying for it, you know,
it's almost like
cheaper, and you're like, oh, well, you know, it's cheaper, so I'm going to buy that part without really and knowing that the reliability of when you put that in is going to potentially harm the one important thing that you've got.
It's almost maybe this is a business idea for us later.
Maybe, let's
but it's almost like what we need is
we get amped up on this.
We obviously want to have our repair workshop that we're planning for next year, but it's almost like what there needs to be is there's a list of criteria that need to be checked off to guarantee that a repair workshop is doing the right things, it's doing a reliable repair, they have in bearing heaters, they've got the knowledge, and it almost like needs someone to go in and do a bit of an audit, go up there and say, you know, are we doing this, are we doing that, are we doing this? And if they have, boom, maintain reliability, seal of approval.
Yeah, but we can create that. All it's about is creating a set of standards of what we're doing in terms of quality. And how we deliver that, and what does it mean? Yeah. Because there's no point in saying, oh, we do all of these things for no reason. It's got to have an outcome. And the outcome is better reliability. And whoever is interested in that, which we all should be,
yep,
as engineering managers, plant managers, stakeholders, operations directors, anyone that involved in that business, we know that reliability applies to everyone. Health and safety, everything improves, so many metrics. That is where I think the industry needs to go. If we're going to be more sustainable, we're going to be more accountable for what we're doing in terms of energy losses as well, because all of this ties into that. And we're going to strive to be better in the future.
Yep.
That is where it needs to go.
And I think, like, as a real important thing to say as well before we wrap up, is that if you're a business that doesn't yet have someone in some capacity that is focusing on reliability, whether that is you're looking at it having a dedicated reliability engineer, or you've got someone that has got measures that are reliability focused, you need to start that now.
Yeah, 100%. Because, yeah, this is a long process. This is what I think people kind of sometimes a little bit naive about.
There's a lot of work that has to be done.
So much work and that needs to be done.
And it's not impossible to do either with a good structure. But what I feel we're seeing at the moment is that with the smaller customers that we work with, is that there is a perception that with reliability, they can just outsource it. We'll get someone else to come sort the reliability. Yeah,
we can buy that.
We can buy that.
you can't.
And this is why we've got to form a team.
It can be helped. It can be supported. Fast-tracked to a degree, but you need to have the right foundation in place and
an
expectation in the business that this needs to be there forever.
Yeah.
Because without it, you're always going to be in the old way of doing things. It's never going to be proactive. It's never going to be
futuristic. We can go in and give that support and do those kind of things, but like, how long are we at that site before we have to go somewhere else?
Well, exactly. But not even that. We're always here to support that site, but it just becomes in different ways.
It's just us doing it and there's no one at site, that reliability message just gets liquidated.
It does. And that's why it's so important as well to have a look at how are you filling that position within your plant to make it sustainable.
Yes.
Because there's no point in bringing loads of people, spending loads of money, getting a system that looks good without anyone pushing it at site level. Because we're not going to be there forever. Even if we're on site for a week, it still doesn't have the integral presence to be able to be sustainable.
And we don't understand the business as well as they do. And
it's their business.
And they're going to know the metrics and the numbers. We can come in and with the criticality analysis and give the tools and give the training. And
we still need their input, don't we?
We still need that level of input. And there still needs to be someone that can say, you know, these are our business metrics. These are our costs. These are our whatever they may be to factor all into that. And this is where I think that, you know, these reliability roles are going to get more important.
But as well, the role of existing repair shops, existing businesses that are doing, you know, great jobs. I'm not saying no one's doing a bad job, but now we've got to start looking at the measure for how do we make sure that whatever we do is done in the best possible way, which may potentially go against business models of why they do it in the first place.
Yeah.
There's a potential danger and we can't bury our heads under the ground anymore. We've got to understand where the future's going and understand how do we improve it and make it better. And it's innovate or die.
Yeah.
On that note, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. We're going to keep you updated about what we're doing and where we're going. Thank you so much for listening to me and we'll get amped up about...
I feel like we got in a bit of a zone there.
I think I don't even know how long that was. 40 minutes. That's not too bad. That's not too bad. So guys, take care.